Welcome to another Early Years Learning Hub podcast. My name is Jackie Ward and I'm the founder and managing director of the Early Years Learning Hub. Today we are discussing visual arts and I'm delighted to be joined by Gay Lindsay, who is a renowned academic in and a gifted practitioner slash inspirational speaker on this topic. Gay, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your professional journey?
Sure. Well, as you just said, I'm working as an academic. I'm currently a senior lecturer at the University of Wollongong in the early years degree there, birth to five. But really, my background is grounded in early childhood teaching. So for more than 22 years, I was a preschool teacher, director, practitioner, while raising a family as well, before I then decided to go back to uni and at that point had planned to do a Master's of Research, but it quickly became a PhD simply because the data I began to collect was so profound and impactful that my supervisors recommended it expand to be a PhD study. I'd never had an ambition to be a doctor, a PhD graduate, but that's sort of the doors that opened. And really, I credit my love of visual arts and my advocacy heart for being the reason I took that journey toward postgraduate study. Lots of people continually told me I should give it a go and give back to the sector, but it was really because I had throughout my 22 years a burning desire to see visual arts practice expand and become richer than what I was seeing in the classroom. Because what I came across throughout my career was, one, educators who didn't think they were artistic. So that really rang some alarm bells for me, that in an environment where we centralise arts materials and processes, where it's part of our everyday early childhood practice, so many of the adults in the room were claiming that they weren't artistic and didn't know what to do with children. And into that gap of not knowing what to do, all I was seeing was lots of very stereotyped teacher-directed, structured activities being rolled out in the name of arts and crafts, when I saw that they were actually inhibiting children's ability to learn the language of the arts and to become visual thinkers and visual communicators. And so I guess that, in a nutshell, is what sort of brought me on this journey. I've now been teaching for about, scary to say, 37 years. So yeah, how did we get that old that fast? But anyway, it's the joy of my life actually to have my academic career focus on visual arts practice in the early childhood space, because I think it opens up more doors than just visual arts. It actually opens people up to inquiry-based learning approaches, to holistic curriculum approaches, to working in multidisciplinary ways with children and with colleagues. And it also opens up the hearts of early childhood educators to realise that they can recapture that artistic voice that is buried deep within every single one of us as human beings. So it's sort of supporting educators to recapture their human right to engage in the arts fully and creatively. Yeah.
Wow. Well, that was a big intro. And
it was, really.
No, I love it. And I've got to say, Gay and I have known each other for quite a while and crossed paths when we were both delivering some professional learning way back when. And I have, as I said, been inspired myself personally. And when I guess, you know, a lot of those times I was in, you know, policy roles and where I didn't get to apply a lot of your wisdom. Now I'm teaching again. I'm really inspired to, you know, like engage with the arts. And I couldn't agree more. I'm probably not doing it as well as I could. And I'm constantly trying to.
We're all learning everywhere. Yeah. You know, I would go into a when I go into classrooms, I still do things and think, oh, I'd do that differently next time. Like, I think we need to be more forgiving of ourselves and just know that if our goal is to give children's voice a platform, then we're doing a good job. That's the big question for me. Is this experience elevating the voice and the ideas of the child, or is it elevating the voice and the control of the adult.
That's the
yardstick by which to sort of evaluate any experience we offer to children, I think.
Well, that's amazing. And I think, you know, one of the things I'll just sort of piggyback on what you've said, all of what you've said there, Gay, is the fact that, you know, once children get into the school system, you know, there's subjects that are called creative arts, but really they are really stencils, you know, sure, proformers, all that kind of stuff. So I think if we don't allow children to develop their confidence and their interest and engagement in expressing themselves through a variety of different mediums, then they miss the opportunity, don't they? And they become one of the people that go, well, I'm no good at that, because, you know, they don't get the freedom to do it later on. So I think it's such an important thing in early childhood, because it's a missed opportunity otherwise.
Oh, definitely. And the fact that, you know, if I was to walk down the main street of my hometown right now and do a vox populi sort of question to everyone on the street, are you creative or are you artistic? I know for a fact that probably 85-90% of people would say no. And I think that's just the most incredible tragedy, that our creativity and our willingness to see ourselves as makers and doers and people who are capable of expressing their ideas in ways that aren't limited to writing and reading or mathematics, or, you know, that's a human right that has been taken away from the bulk of the population. And yet Convention on the Rights of the Child say this is a human right that we must honour. And can you imagine the world if more of the children in our schooling system experienced the success of their ways of expressing and being and doing, if they were valued as highly as performing well on an APLAN test is valued? And I just think the world would be a better place. Humans would be more rounded. Mental health wouldn't be experiencing the risks that it is right now, the pressures that it is right now. And so that's my mission, is to start from the ground up with the youngest citizens and empower their teachers to honour children's rights. And hopefully then the advocacy that can come from that is when people see that form of teaching that actually elevates children's ideas and thinking. It's powerful stuff, you know. It really does speak to being a whole human being instead of being put into compartments and categorised as to whether you're good at performing on a test or not. I mean, that's the tragedy of our society, I think.
Yeah, you raise a really good point, because if we think about, like, I'm just thinking about a few experiences that I had last week around, you know, like the integrated learning kind of side of things. For example, we had some paints out on some black paper. So, nice. I mean, I could have thrown it over the children to say, how can we solve this problem of knowing whose artwork it is? But I ended up just grabbing some stickers out and then, you know, writing people's names. And I just asked people, you know, whose name is this? And obviously a few children realised. But so a great literacy opportunity. But also there was another little boy, because it's obviously the start of the year, so we don't know them very well, who was reading everyone's names. And I go, I think, you know, little so-and-so can actually read. And then so that was a great way. I might not have known that if we hadn't have gone through that whole opportunity of the fact that we were doing painting on black paper, you know. And, you know, last year doing some still life drawing and that sort of, you know, all that mass that's involved with that, you know, looking at the size and the proportion and how you can position that on your page, you know. So much valuable learning that, you know, you're not just doing art and craft.
Exactly. It's multidisciplinary. And you think of the work of an artist, you know, they are the critical thinkers in our society who are reflecting on their lived experience and then communicating that or twisting ideas around a metaphor. I mean, it's deeper level thinking that when we empower children to express their thinking in ways that aren't just linear and predictable, then we actually empower them to embrace their own cognitive processes, to be more aware of things like the dispositions for learning, is what I think arts experience elevates. You know, it is about problem solving. It is about overcoming frustration. It is about divergent thinking. It's about trial and error. It's about persistence. It's about not giving up even when something is frustrating or hard. And, you know, people sometimes put art into that Friday afternoon category that we do it when we're too tired to do the real work of school or early childhood. And yet it should just be integrated every day across the curriculum in the same way that music and dance should be integrated. You know, if we're really going to appeal to the 100 languages of children, as they call it in Reggio Emilia in Italy, or as Howard Gardner calls it, the multiple intelligences that human beings carry, the different ways we creatively think and communicate and solve problems, then we're really empowering children to play to their strengths. And we're listening to their strengths and giving them a richer repertoire of how to operate in this world. And, you know, I often say to my students and to colleagues that, you know, when I watch the opening ceremony of the Olympics, which is the most watched event on the planet ever, you know, when that rolls around every few years, I mean, I don't know if the ratings are still going as highly. It feels like, yeah, who knows, maybe it's not as popular as it used to be. But people tune into that. And what I think is it's not about the sport at that point. The opening ceremony is about the dancers, the artists, the costume designers, the painters, the set designers, the creatives, the musicians, the dancers, all of that, the acrobats. And I often think of those people and wonder whether they loved school or not. Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of them they didn't, because their skills and values were not elevated. I think in early childhood and in the earlier years of primary school, we just have such a rich opportunity to make children feel good about themselves and to have them see themselves as valued contributors to their society with huge potential. And I think that is enriched when we work holistically and across the curriculum, and where to learn about a science concept, you're drawing your theories first, you know. Yeah. Or where to learn about the experimentation process, you're experimenting with colour mixing. So the arts just integrates so beautifully with all of your other, you know, so-called serious learning domains.
Well, I think, you know, also to sort of circle back to the whole wellbeing thing as well, it's a great, like the process of arts is a great way to support children to self-regulate, and absolutely, to also feel great and have a growth mindset as well, that I made this, you know, yeah, like I've exactly produced something that I think is magnificent and beautiful, you know. Mm-hmm. I was just talking to my children recently about how I did some little projects in our old house, our family home, where, you know, I made some, you know, tiles with some glass beads on it, and I'd done some mosaics and things, and how proud I was to contribute in that way, you know, for those things, and I could call them mine. And the fact that visual arts often is something we can continue to come back and look at continues to make us feel really good about ourselves and what we can achieve, I think.
Yeah, I think it can make us feel good about ourselves if the adults in our lives have continually sent us that message. But if people undervalue the arts, or if a child or a young adult, whoever, experiences frustration with an arts process, because often you'll imagine what you want in your head and then your skill level might not match that because nobody's ever taught you how to use the materials or solve those drawing problems or painting problems or whatever. And so sometimes people give up on art because they don't feel competent at it. And the irony is that they're often never taught. You know, like even in our teacher training courses, not enough coursework is dedicated to the actual practical skills and knowledge. Like a lot is learned about the theory of, yes, this is very important for children's development, blah, blah, blah. But until an adult actually engages with the process, they haven't got a chance of overcoming that low self-efficacy that they might have developed through all their years of schooling, which made them feel like they couldn't do art. And so it's about hopefully sort of shifting the dynamic back to the yes, I can type approach to it, so that all people should get through to the end of the school system with a really rich repertoire of possibilities for themselves. And I fear that often it's a very narrowed repertoire. You know, the more we go through the system, the less we use our bodies, the less we the less divergent thinking is encouraged. I mean, even when one of my children did HSC art, they said it actually sort of squashed their capacity because the teacher was trying to direct them in ways that would make them do well in the in the testing side of it, rather than doing well in their own exploration of the arts. And I mean, the joy of art is that there aren't rules, and or there shouldn't be. You know, that it is, it should be open-ended. It should be a realm of possibilities for play and experimentation with materials. But too many people put the label on being an artist as being somebody who earns their living by hanging their work on the gallery wall or selling it, instead of just seeing art is a language, is a visual language like any other language. But to learn it, we have to be taught it, we have to be exposed to it, we have to experience it. And for too many people, that experience stops either in the early years or in the early years of school. I think that's a tragedy. We do yearn for it, though. Do you remember during the pandemic when some people had spare time? I know I didn't, because we did double the teaching during the pandemic.
I was the same. We were
online,
really busy.
Online. But for the people who were looking for something to do, a lot of them went to the arts to bring richness into their lives, even if that was only watching Netflix 24/7. But that's the arts too, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that fascinated me, that a lot of people picked up their knitting needles, their stitching, their drawing pads, their paint box.
Yeah.
Because when they were looking for nurturing and fulfillment, that's where they went. And I find that quite fascinating, that the human yearning to be creative and visually communicative is still buried deep within our DNA.
It's there, yeah, definitely. I'm interested, just as a little side note there, because I've got a, he's nearly five, grandson, and he's really lacking a lot of confidence with a lot of things. You know, like I'm thinking about the beach pool recently, he didn't want to go in there, but he often says to him, you know, to me, no, I can't do that, that's wrong, when he's drawing something. And I'm like, trying to encourage him, and I'm just interested to hear your thoughts on how do you sort of, you know, because I've also witnessed when children get too much instruction. So what's the kind of right balance, I guess, for that?
For me, it's about bringing back the play with art materials just to a meeting with materials. That's what I call it. Have a meeting with materials. And that what that means for me is that you're just providing the materials and a platform. And then the most important ingredient when a child is encouraged to just experiment with the materials is not to have any pressure on making something or even drawing something in particular, but that as the adult partner in that play and inquiry, I think the adult should be modelling the mark making of that material and just, you know, parallel play with the child. Not to draw something for them to copy, absolutely not, but just to sort of model the problem solving, model the disposition of giving it a go even though it feels a bit scary, or modelling a way to start. Like if the child is sort of a bit hibernated or a bit frozen and they don't quite know where to start, then you can kind of prompt that by doing a scribble on the page and just going, oh, I love the way this pencil makes a rich, creamy mark. Like, just take it away from the focus on what you're drawing or what you're producing to just be experimentation with that material and what it can do. And then children will often ask adults to draw for them, and that's the beginning, I think, of that lack of confidence, because they think the way an adult draws is better than the way they draw. I always used to refuse to draw for children, and what I would express to them is, no, no, you can do it. Let's figure it out together, you know, and then model that step-by-step problem-solving attitude. So, you know, I'd say, well, what is it you're trying to draw? And then I would scaffold, basically, and say, oh, well, if you're wanting to draw a dinosaur, let's go to the sandpit and get the dinosaur toys out of the sandpit and bring them in here to the drawing table. And let's feel them and touch them and run our fingers over the ziggy-zaggy lines that go down the dinosaur's back. And then it's a case of saying, okay, well, that's a really ziggy-zaggy line. It goes up and it goes down and it goes up and it goes down. And then you can say, let's make that ziggy-zaggy line with our big arm, you know, and do some big body movements before you then have a go at making that ziggy-zaggy line on paper. So it's sort of really just I call it deconstruction. So you sort of deconstruct the end goal and break it into its elemental parts and sort of think to yourself, well, if you've never used charcoal before, let's say we're drawing with charcoal, if you've never used charcoal before, then your first charcoal experience shouldn't be to draw something. It should just be to get to know charcoal, you know, have a meeting with charcoal, learn what it can do, what happens when you rub your finger in it. And so I think the adult can model that freedom and that that decision not to be tied to an end product, but to really communicate that you value the child's efforts, you value their persistence, you value their willingness to give something a go. And then when they produce something that's scribbly, we don't go, that's just scribble. We go, that's an amazing use of the charcoal. I love the way you made it really dark over here, or I love the way it's smudged down in that corner. You know, and that way we foster a growth mindset, because when we praise and provide hollow praise, like, oh, you're so creative, what that does is gives children no guideline about where that praise is coming from or what it's for. Whereas if we praise their dispositions, that produces growth mindset, because then the next time they draw, they'll remember that you praise them for trying really hard or for not giving up. Rather than if you say to them, oh, that's so creative, and they drew a stick figure, then guaranteed the next time they do a drawing, they'll do the exact same. It's sort of like almost stagnates their development, because they want the praise, they remember you were positive about what they drew, instead of the attitudes they expressed when they were drawing. So I really like to encourage people to be careful not to praise in a broad, your creative kind of way, because that means, that's, how do you define that to a young child?
That's a really good point. And I love the fact that you've mentioned a few things that really have resonated with me in the past. That idea of, you know, teacher or educator as co-learner. So you you don't need to already know or be a great artist yourself. You can learn along the way. And the other thing is really emphasizing working with children and teaching techniques, you know, like, you know, using the side of the pencil gives a bit of a shading effect. And so you're exploring all those things. If you don't know all those things, there's heaps of YouTube videos out there and you can learn them that way. But that idea that you you're teaching children this repertoire of, you know, when I press hard, the charcoal makes a darker mark, or when I do smudge it with my finger, I can get a smudgy effect. So these are all the skills that you need, isn't it, to create more complex art?
Yeah. And that modelling is really important. And I love the notion of co-learning, because it sort of lets teachers off the hook. You don't have to be an expert in everything. There's no way a generalist teacher can be an expert in every domain of learning that they teach. But what I do like is something, I think it's Tiziana Filippini who says it in Reggio Emilia. She says the competent child needs a competent educator. And she reminds us that if children are going to speak the 100 languages of children, then the adults better get their heads around at least 99 languages, just to be a step ahead of the competent child. And I really like that thinking, because it still puts the responsibility on the adult to build their knowledge and their repertoire of skills. So it's not a complete discovery learning for the adult. And so I always say that as the adult in a classroom, you need to have played with those materials before you put them on the table for children, because then you know what some of the possibilities are. You have thought about some of the repertoire and the skills that you can draw attention to when you notice children exhibiting certain techniques. Then you can draw attention to that and that and say, oh, Tommy just used the side of his pencil and that made an amazing effect. Tommy, can you show everyone else exactly how you hold the pencil to do that? And so you make children the experts, as well as offering and lending your knowledge and expertise you know, as the moment arises. So it's not a direct teaching situation where the adult's going, right, children, now hold this and do that. It's like blah, blah, blah. They don't get a chance to even discover anything themselves if we teach that way. So it's about being that co-learner, co-partner, co-researcher, working alongside the children, but also being the teacher, not abdicating the responsibility to teach.
Yeah, so and what a great way to prep for your experiences, because you'd be having fun yourself, wouldn't you, learning
well,
all
exactly,
that.
Exactly, but you also figure out what's not going to work well. Sometimes people buy materials and then once the children are using them, you go, oh, those pencils are useless. Well, we should just never even give the children the useless ones. We should test them out prior and make sure they work. The same with you shouldn't ever, I don't think you should ever put felt pens out that aren't luscious and rich and wet. You know, those dried out felt pens are nothing but frustrating, or those $2 pencils that don't make a mark on the page. I mean, some cheap pencils do work beautifully, but you've got to test them out to make sure that whatever we offer children provides a rich, responsive sort of relationship with the material, because then that will keep children focused and really in the zone. Whereas I've seen in classrooms where the materials might be really poor or they break or they're substandard, and children will go, they'll make a mark like scribble, scribble, and then they move away because it's not giving them any feedback. So that's why I think playing with the materials, checking out the paint, making sure it's the right consistency to work on the page, depending whether you're at an easel or a table. It's about pre-planning. I call it mitigating for disaster. Yeah. So, you know, like if you know that an experience you're going to put out is probably going to be messy and that your colleagues will roll their eyes and say, oh, here she goes again, she's making a mess, we're going to have to clean up, then you actually make a list for yourself of all the things you need to prepare and put into place to prevent that disaster from happening. So mitigate for disaster by making sure your floor is covered if it's going to be drippy, by having some hand washing facilities nearby. If the sink is too far away, you bring hand washing or wet wipes or whatever right to your side so that you have the full kit of materials required to make that experience really positive and effective, and so that you as the adult can stay in situ. You're not going to walk off and go, oh, I left such and such in the kitchen, and then while you're gone, children don't stop playing and using the materials, so they might end up on the wall or on each other. And if you don't, look, if you're into that, fine. I don't necessarily think that kind of messy play is very constructive unless it's an intentionally mess-making sensory experience. But to teach children how to respect materials and each other, for me, that's part of the arts learning experience. You know, yes, we're individuals, but we're individuals within a community, and we have responsibilities to each other. And if we claim to be focusing on sustainable practice, then we should be sustainable in our arts practice as well as much as we are in any other part of the program. And so planning ahead and having everything you need to make an experience really positive and effective, and where you can be an ever-present support, model, guide on the side, step in as required, but also do lots of listening and observing, then children love your company. So I say that the adult at the art table is probably the most important ingredient, simply because you're there with the support, the guidance, the prompts, the questions to really turn what is an activity into a learning experience. Our responsibility is to deliver learning experiences, not just entertainment activities.
That's a really good point. Well, I'm interested to hear you talk a little bit about mediums, because I always love to hear you talk about mediums. So have you got, like, we've talked a little bit about a few things.
Yeah, charcoal, we've talked about pencils, paint, drawing. So you want to hear about some others?
Yeah, sculpting, clay, sewing, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I've actually got a really helpful little table in my Everyday Learning booklet from Early Childhood Australia. Some of you will probably have already come across that. And so I find that, you know, if you categorise all the drawing materials available, so think about not just pencils and crayons and felt pens, but Sharpies and ink. You know, India ink drawn with a stick is a wonderful drawing medium. It's a liquid drawing medium. And so I like to sort of suggest that if we were to look at a table like that, that has drawing, painting, collage, 3D construction, printmaking, there's so many different printmaking techniques that children really respond to beyond doing the object printing that is fairly typical in early childhood. So for printmaking, you can do mono printing with block printers inks. You can do gel plate printing, which is the most delightful sensory responsive printmaking method ever. I just absolutely love it for early childhood because it's very manageable. It's very conservative on its use of paint, but the results you get are really, really powerful. And I've done that with children as young as 2 years of age can do gel plate printing. Having said that, their first meeting with gel plate printing is just to hold the gel plate in their hand because it's lovely and sensory and wobbly. So you don't have to be making art to learn the art skills, materials and tools. What else? There's things like box construction and collage, of course, so the whole repertoire with glue. And I also really like to encourage people not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Too many people have stopped doing the traditional crafts and artisan processes that are central and that children are so responsive to. So things like stitching and weaving and threading, sewing, those skills are part of our cultural heritage. And they're being lost to our society because early childhood services have stopped doing them, schools have stopped doing them to a large extent, perhaps because they worry that they've got step-by-step instructions and you have to teach technique. But I tell you what, if you've got a rowdy group of children, then having a quiet time where everyone is doing some stitching or whereas at least a small group of children are really focused on stitching on with some hessian and lovely big chenille needles which have the blunt end but the big eye that you can thread wool and stuff through. And I've got a little trick that I've actually put into our latest book that explains how to thread a needle so that children can thread the needle. So you don't have to be sitting there licking the the furry wool. So that I'll mention that as well. So in about August, September, later this year, a beautiful new book is coming out with Routledge, which actually has, it's called Art, Play and Inquiry, and it's the why, the what and the how of visual arts with young children. And so the third part of that book literally takes what was a little table in my ECA booklet, and it is a whole repertoire of the techniques, methods, materials, skills associated with all of the different potential art forms for early childhood. And so I'm really excited about that. It's going to be a really visual book, so there's well over 100 images from services around the world that I and my co-authors have collaborated with. So, yeah, it's going to be a brilliant resource, I think, for people.
I can't wait to get my copy.
Yeah, it's going to be great. The other thing I should probably mention, because it's coming up in the near future, for fear of dating this podcast for down the track, but I'm associated with the International Art in Early Childhood Association, and I'll be hosting the 10th International Art in Early Childhood Conference this year at UOW in July. If anyone's interested in that, I can share the link to the information about that to you, Jackie, and we can put it out.
So that would be great.
Yeah, anyone who's really keen to build their visual arts practice with young children, this conference, it's a biannual conference, and I've been going to it since about 2013 or something, like a long time. Wow. And it's just the world's leading practitioners and academics in this space who come together every 2 years but we've also got some really exciting local presenters.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be presenting sharing my story. By no means an expert, but just a practitioner sharing a journey.
I think practitioners sharing their journey of learning is really powerful because, you know, an avalanche starts with one snowflake, doesn't it? So we've just all got to do our bits. And I think it's just exciting because more and more conversations I'm having with educators, with colleagues around the world, is that people are yearning for a richer curriculum that recognises the creative side of people's humanity. And so I think this work that we do around visual arts practice, it feeds people's souls, and we need that in our sector, right? Because people are feeling a little bit hemmed in by all of the regulatory pressures and so on. But if we can return back to the kinds of teaching that bring us joy but that also enrich children's learning and experience, then everyone wins. And it can be much more fulfilling to work that way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It feels to me like, you know, there's a lot of hot topic, slow pedagogy, but it kind of reminds me of this idea that we spend time, we nurture children's skills. That's what slow pedagogy is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Which to me is really early childhood pedagogy.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is. But that reminder to slow down and focus on stuff that matters and to take our time doing it. That philosophy of slow pedagogy sits perfectly with the work you do in the art studio. It just is so aligned with that valuing of who the children are and giving them multiple ways to express their identity, and that doesn't have to happen in one activity. It's actually a long, slow journey that we get to be privileged to be part of. So, yeah, I think it's a perfect alignment, really.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. I think you and I can talk about this topic forever and ever and ever, but I think it's been a really great podcast. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it. Make sure we put links to things in the show notes, and thank you so much, Gay, for joining us.
My pleasure. I'll talk to you soon.
So, it's up for another Early Years Learning Hub podcast episode, Unpacking Theory and Research. If you'd like to find out more, go to our website, earlyyearslearninghub.com.au.